Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley. And our guest today is Nina Gilbo. Did I say that right?
Close enough.
And she is the author of The Good Eater, A Vegan's Search for the Future of Food. Now, Nina Gilbo, PhD, is a sociologist, author, and educator. Co-founder of Plant Futures, a nonprofit affiliated with UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business. She has consulted for major food brands, and her scholarly work has been covered by media such as The Atlantic, The Telegraph, etc. She, in addition to a PhD in sociology from Harvard, she holds a certificate of plant-based nutrition from the T. Colin Campbell Center for Nutrition Studies, and is the co-author of Habits of Inequality. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Nina.
Thank you for having me. I'm honored, Monica.
So I think you're the third PhD in a row that I've had on the show.
Too many academics.
Well, but all writing about really interesting topics. So 2 weeks ago would be Eleanor Spicer Rice, who did the secret, your pet's secret lives, and just some fascinating things about animals.
Yeah.
And then I was talking to, I'm drawing a blank here. I was talking to, well, I'll come back to another doctor, put it that way. And, who was writing about, he's a biogeochemist, which was really interesting too. So you are a sociologist, and as I understand, this book, The Good Eater, is kind of outgrowth of your dissertation.
Yes, that's right. The book took me about 3 years to write, but I always say that the origin story of the book really starts 10 years ago, about a decade ago, when I began my dissertation at Harvard University. And so, yes, I'm a sociologist by training, sociologist of culture, and my dissertation was all about the rise of the vegan lifestyle movement around the world. And for that dissertation, I did a comparative study. So I compared the U.S., France and Israel. I'm actually currently in France, so it's interesting to be back. Yes, to see, you know, how far and also not how far the vegan movement has continued to grow here. And so yes, the book began as my project during a postgraduate work when I was at UC Berkeley at the Sustainable Food Initiative. So really this project is about a decade old at this point.
Wow. What drew you to this topic? Because I, you know, understand from what you write that maybe you weren't entirely encouraged to pursue the history of veganism, the movement, as part of your, as your dissertation. But what drew you to it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, if somebody had told me that, first of all, I would be vegan, and second, that I would write a whole dissertation and a book on this topic, I would have never believed them. You know, I didn't grow up with parents who were hippies, you know, in the 1970s, nothing like that. And so, and as you mentioned, my advisors at Harvard weren't too excited about this topic, because, you know, as they rightly pointed out, if I wanted an academic job, I should pick a topic that was less niche, you know, because culturally still, this is a niche movement. So, you know, the people who identify as vegan are still 1-3% of the population. There is, though, at the same time, a rise in reduction of meat, you know, flexitarians and so on. And so I was interested in the general movement toward plant-based eating and away from animal product consumption. But yes, as you rightly pointed out, my professor at Harvard, who is my advisor, who's a wonderful person and has actually been very supportive of the book now. But in the beginning, when I first told her I wanted to write on this topic, she really discouraged me because she said, you know, vegans are only 2% of the population. I think you should pick a topic that's more, you know, more mainstream, which makes sense. But at the time, what drew me was, so, you know, I was in the middle of my graduate program. I was about to choose a dissertation topic. And my grandfather, with whom I was very close, this is something I write about in the book, he passed away prematurely from chronic disease. He had both cancer and diabetes. And, you know, at the time, I was already vegetarian, but it wasn't a big part of my identity at all. But his death actually inspired me to look at the link between diet and disease, something that I had really never bothered to do before. And I was shocked to learn about the nutritional research that has shown for a long time that a predominantly plant-based diet can is the only diet really that can not only prevent but actually reverse chronic disease. And so that inspired me to look at the health angle. And then after that, I looked more into the environmental impact of food, so the outsized impact of meat, dairy, and eggs on our planet. And then that also inspired me to look into the ethical implications of eating animal products. That includes not only how animals are treated on industrial farms, what we call factory farming, but also the human cost as well, the slaughterhouse workers and how they're treated. And even, of course, as I talk about in the book, plant-based eating is not ethically perfect either. We have, farm workers who pick our vegetables. And so there are a lot of issues in the food system. But I really was inspired because I saw this movement growing on the world and I wanted to understand why. As a cultural sociologist, we're interested in phenomena that, have been mainstream traditionally and then sorry, a fringe have been traditionally and then they move into the mainstream. And we see this also with feminism and civil rights and nowadays with psychedelics.
Oh, yeah, that's a whole nother topic, isn't it? One thing that I found really interesting was that was when you write about the history of vegetarianism and veganism, a lot of things I really didn't know. But, I live in a community where we have a lot of vegetarians because this is, I'm in Fairfield,
Oh,
Iowa.
really?
Yeah, Fairfield, Iowa, which is the home of the MIU, the Maharishi International University. So a lot of meditators are
Oh,
vegetarian.
fascinating.
Yeah, we had at one point, I think, the highest, largest per capita number of vegetarian restaurants in the country or something like that for a small
That's
town.
fascinating. I need to come
Yeah.
visit.
And yeah, definitely. And I did spend, and then I spend the rest of my time in Austin, which of course is, pretty vegetarian friendly as well. We do have one really good vegan restaurant here, but most of the people I know who are not lifelong but became vegetarians probably in their 20s and now are in their 60s and 70s aren't drawn towards that step towards veganism at all, because for them, I think for a lot of them, their vegetarianism is aligned with Indian vegetarianism, and Indian diets are pretty heavy on dairy. And I know quite a few who don't eat eggs, but most people will eat dairy. And but here I'm in Iowa. I went to a wedding last weekend, a family wedding, and the only food options were beef and pork. And whereas most of the people that I am around day to day wouldn't ever consider doing that, would always have a chicken or fish option, even if they were in an area. It's so how mainstream is it really? Because when I mentioned to the bride and groom something about that, and they just looked at me blankly, like, well, when I said, well, my friend doesn't eat pork, and they go, well, there was beef.
Well, as you say, there's a lot of variation across the country and around the world. And of course, India, the notion of ahimsa, nonviolence, that's really what inspired me to be vegetarian. And originally, I started doing yoga when I was a teenager and was really inspired by that notion. It's also what inspired Gandhi and many other activists throughout history to adopt a plant-based diet. And as you say, this is a very old movement. I was, really surprised to learn that the threads of this movement, the roots actually go back to antiquity with figures like Pythagoras, who's of course known as a mathematician and a philosopher, but he's actually an advocate also of plant-based eating all the way through the Renaissance man himself, Leonardo da Vinci. Tolstoy, many other luminaries throughout history, and of course Gandhi, who Tolstoy actually inspired in part. His idea of nonviolence actually inspired Gandhi to go back to his own roots culturally. And as you say, many who became vegetarian in the 60s and 70s, this was part of the counterculture. People were going to India, they were inspired by Indian philosophy, and many adopted what we would call today a lacto-ovo-vegetarian diet. But really, honestly, I think of this all as one movement. I don't really think of veganism, vegetarianism as separate. And part of that is because even the person who coined the term vegan, Donald Watson, who is an Englishman, he himself came out of the kind of vegetarian movement and then said, that traditionally actually vegetarianism, that term, or what was before called a Pythagorean diet, that referred to an entirely plant-based diet without any animal products in it. But over time, it became muddled. And then in India, historically, of course, cows are considered sacred. So, people there do eat dairy. But there is kind of just a general consciousness around not eating at least meat, meat from animal flesh. But as you rightly point out, I mean, many say that veganism is really just a phenomenon on the coasts of the country rather than in the middle of the country, and in industrialized countries rather than kind of industrializing countries. And there's some truth to to these claims. At the same time, there are pockets also throughout the country, as you mentioned, Austin is an example. And I think, for example, one thing that I was really amazed to learn about is the predominance of plant-based eating among African Americans or the African diaspora around
I
the
was
world.
surprised about
And
that too. Yeah.
absolutely. And so actually proportionally speaking, more if we actually look at the proportions of people who are eating a plant-based diet, many more African Americans are actually plant-based than white Americans. And so that was a really interesting phenomenon. There are also religious roots there, Rastafarianism, Ital cuisine, the Hebrew Israelites who live in Israel. So there are these pockets around the world. And certainly when I say that this is becoming a more of a mainstream phenomenon, I want to clarify we're still in the very much early adopter phase, right? So
Right,
in the
right.
grand scheme of this curve of diffusion, as we call it in sociology, we're still in the early days. That being said, even the fact that people have heard of the term, know what this means, is already evidence of the fact that it's becoming more mainstream. So some people might be like shocked that there are only beef and pork at a wedding, and that is honestly still the mainstream. But with social change, with feminism, with gay and lesbian rights, with psychedelics, with all these kind of phenomena that were fringe and become mainstream, there's always a period of time where there's a kind of lag, and then eventually it becomes more accepted. So this is part of this phenomenon, and it's really only in the last, I would say, 5 to 10 years that it's really kind of penetrated the public consciousness. And I think over time, especially we see this in Gen Zs too, younger people are much more aware of the environmental impact, especially of food. So there's also a generational shift happening.
I think that's true. Yeah, I can see that. I was raised with a mostly plant-based diet, but not my dad grew a lot of our own food. He was really into sustainable agriculture, organic food. We did eat meat, but we would go to the farmer where we knew how the beef was raised, have it
That's how I
butchered.
wish most people ate, to be
Yeah.
honest. What I really advocate for is less that everyone necessarily become vegan, although, as I say, I'm philosophically and ethically vegan. But if we were to go back to eating meat like that way, where it was like a few times a week or once a week, and it was treated with respect, and that it was really acknowledged that this was a rare thing and that like a life was taken in the production of this food, I think there's just such a disconnect between what's on our plate and our consciousness around how it got there. So we're part of this long food chain, and we have so little consciousness around actually how that food ends up on our plate. It's not just about animals, although that's of course what this book is mostly about. It's also about how the food is grown, organic, regenerative, all these like local, et cetera. And so I always say for me, veganism is the start of a conversation rather than the end of the conversation, because the food system is very complex. And I think those of us who are in the food movement are just interested in becoming more what I would call a good eater, which is just somebody who is more conscious about how they eat and what goes onto their plate. I think more of us are becoming aware of these issues, and I think we should all be having productive conversations rather than infighting and trying to kind of morally say you should do this or you should do that. And I always tell other vegans, I definitely went through what I would call like an angry vegan phase where I wanted to convince everybody of my perspective, and I felt that it was the only way to be. And as I say, I'm still very much vegan, but I want to have, helpful and useful conversations with people rather than alienate people. And I always say to others that few people, adopt a new behavior because they were kind of morally forced to do so. And they're much more likely to actually be interested in a lifestyle or a shift in their diet and in their life if it comes from a place of abundance, of curiosity, of exploration. And really, the plant kingdom is so beautiful and abundant that I think it offers so many opportunities for exploration.
Well, I think a good start was calling was when people start referring to it as plant-based
Right.
rather than just vegan.
Right.
Because there's something about vegan that feels like you're taking away something,
Right.
whereas plant-based feels like more expansive.
Inviting. Absolutely. And you know, it's interesting that that term plant-based is so fuzzy, and that's kind of its usefulness in a way, because nobody really knows exactly what it means. I mean, for some it means vegan, for some it means mostly vegan, for others it means, you know, sometimes it means vegan junk food, it means vegan processed food, like some of the alternative protein or the kind of what people would call fake meat. But yeah, I think vegan has, you know, it really the origin of the word is it actually comes from the word vegetarian. And when Donald Watson, actually it was his wife Dorothy who coined the term, they combined the first and the last parts of vegetarian to coin vegan. But over time it's become, you know, it's supposed to be a philosophy of and way of living that seeks to reduce as much as possible the suffering of other beings. But I think it has been, you know, to some extent tainted by the animal rights movement. And I have a lot of respect for animal rights activists. I write about one in my book. And I think they've done a lot to really shift the public consciousness around the moral circle that should be attributed to animals as well as humans. But, you know, the term has taken on this very kind of moral edge that I think turns off a lot of people. In fact, there's sociological research on if you label something as vegan, automatically people think it's less delicious, it's less nutritious, and so on. And so plant-based has been useful. But we definitely have a marketing problem, I think, in the movement, because it's a bit unclear. You know, I personally follow what I would call a whole food plant-based diet, and I'm also vegan philosophically, and that means I eat really foods you would find in a garden, you know, whole grains, vegetables, legumes, and I try to eat like real food that is without animal products. But sometimes when you say plant-based nowadays, it means you're eating like all these different new products, which you know, I think have a purpose, but personally I tend to avoid those.
Right. Now you mentioned that you are back in France,
Yeah.
and you made a comment in here about the brie and the croissants, and so how are you in France, and how you loved those, and so how are you dealing with that?
Well, you know, I've been vegan for almost 10 years now, so it's something I'm used to. And you know, it's interesting because I was the kind of vegetarian that really supplemented all the meat that was lacking in my diet with a ton of dairy. So I was eating yogurt and all the little croissants and the little pastries and cheese and things like that. And you know, France has come a long way. We've actually been able to find you know, cheese made of cashews, just kind of for fun to try to have the French experience. And it's been really, really honestly very similar. But you know, I think there is kind of a rising consciousness here to some extent. So we've been able to find some vegan cafes here and there. And I like to support the people who are kind of trying to live a different way and show a different way of eating. But really, I try to remind people, like, for example, we're in Provence right now, and the Provençal cuisine is actually like there's a lot of chickpeas and figs and strawberries and bread and olives and tapenade. There's so many plant-based ingredients, you know, in every world cuisine. In fact, all throughout history, all throughout the world, plants have really been the cornerstone of our cuisine. And meat and dairy products played a minimal role. It's only in the last 50 to 7 years, including in France, that these have become you know, centerpieces of our diets. But really, if we look at the kind of natural ingredients that have been part of every world cuisine, it's mostly plants.
So why are people like, I have a friend who was vegetarian for many, many years and now is eating only meat. It's the whole
Oh,
keto
really?
thing.
Carnivore. Oh, keto.
Carnivore. Yes,
Yes.
carnivore.
That's
Why?
quite a shift.
I know. I know. And I don't get it. But
Well,
why
frankly,
do people think that that is the way humans were supposed to eat? What is, do you have any idea?
you know, actually, people ask me about paleo and keto. I think carnivore is really the extreme
It
example of they're
is,
mostly eating meat. That is simply not historically in any way accurate. to how humans have eaten. I mean, we are naturally omnivores. We can eat all sorts of food, in the plant, fungi, and animal kingdoms. But historically, just if looking at our digestive tract and so on, we're designed to digest complex carbohydrates. So that's whole grains, legumes, vegetables, and fruits, for the most part, and to some extent, eating small amounts of meat. And historically, I think that the fixation on, keto or paleo, I think that, if funnily enough, I actually think that has more in common with veganism than the way we eat in terms of the standard American diet, because typically those dietary tribes are against processed foods or, away, moving away from processed food, moving toward natural food. So I can understand people's desire to kind of find a more natural diet. And so, I always say, like, if paleos and vegans, if we actually looked at our diets, my diet would just include a lot of beans and legumes, and theirs would include meat, but otherwise they would look quite similar. And keto as well. Keto, I think, is partly a fad around thinking that a high fat diet helps you to lose weight, but we actually don't have long-term research on these diets, and I would guess that they would actually show that over time they would clog arteries, just like a very high meat diet does as well. And unfortunately, I think that there are long-term negative consequences of those diets, even if short-term they appear to lose weight and so on. Carnivore diet is honestly, that one baffles me, because there are no people throughout history who have eaten a basically meat-based diet. The only exception is like in places that were extremely cold, or people don't have other diets that they could eat because they're fresh food. And typically people didn't live as long. So it baffles me. I think, of course you're talking to a vegan, so I'm going to promote a vegan diet, because I think that's, I mean, not even just a vegan. I mean, I'm a scientist, a social scientist, but I've read the nutritional research, and it's very clear that a predominantly plant-based diet, I won't even claim that 100%, but certainly, if you look at any healthy diet, if even the Mediterranean diet, which is often seen as very healthy, it's less about what it contains, but it, more about what it doesn't contain. So yes, there's olive oil, but there's no butter. And yes, there's, it has a lot more grains and legumes than like the standard American diet, for example. So of course, when people adopt a Mediterranean diet, they do better because they're eating more fruits, vegetables, grains, and legumes. And if you look at any healthy diet, the common denominator is pretty much vegetables, typically. So,
Right,
and then
right.
in addition, there might be disagreement around fruits or grains and so on, but for the most part, it's vegetables. So I think people on those diets lose weight and might feel better short term, but long term, they're not getting essential nutrients.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Nina Gilboa, author of The Good Eater, A Vegan Search for the Future of Food. Talk to us a little bit about how the book is structured and how you made the decisions, what you decided to include in this.
I really love that this is a podcast about the craft of writing, because often you're just, ask questions around the content, but I really appreciate that because a lot of thought goes into it. I'm very lucky that one of my mentors is Michael Pollan, who's a writer whose work I admire very deeply. And I remember early on when, I asked him here and there, just kind of like, do you have some writing advice? And I remember he used this analogy of like a laundry line. He said there should be like this narrative arc that's the laundry line, and then there's kind of clothes hanging on it, so you can kind of take tangents, but then you go back to the laundry line. The laundry line, the heart of this book is this question: is there an ethical way to eat? So this is the question that really propels the book. There are many questions around that as well, but that's really the heart of the book. And then I take basically different perspectives on this movement, and in each chapter I basically feature one person who really represents a piece of this movement. And it was actually quite hard to figure out who should that person be, who embodies this particular point that I want to make. I start off the book with talking about the animal rights movement and essentially what went wrong there and why there was a shift toward veganism more as a lifestyle movement. I talk about the rise of alternative proteins, so plant-based, and also cell cultured meat. So these are the new technologies in this movement. So if you've heard of Beyond Meat, for example, I go behind the headquarters, and I interview the CEO of Beyond Meat. And then I look at cell cultured meat, which is essentially meat grown in the laboratory without slaughter. So you can think about like growing a piece of fish or chicken or something like that in a laboratory in a big bioreactor machine. And so I look at that as a solution to the problems in our food system. I look at the investors in the vegan movement who are really trying to finance this movement and trying to bring these products to life into grocery stores all around us. And really, the idea there is to change what's on our plate without necessarily changing hearts and minds. So there's a shift from kind of morally trying to convince people to adopt a plant-based diet toward just making these plant-based products better. And then what I do is I look at the regenerative agriculture movement. So these are some of the critics of veganism. These are folks like I would say Alice Waters of Shape and Neis would be one of them, and others who look at these products and these alternative proteins and really think of them as part of the same processed food playbook as has been around for a long time, and really just want to encourage us to eat food that has been grown locally and regeneratively and organically. And so I look at that movement, but I also say, essentially show that vegans and those who are in the food movement actually have a lot that they have in common. So both are really against factory farming. And so I look at that, and I interview a farmer who tries to marry those philosophies. She's a vegan herself, but on her farm in Maryland, she really tries to bring together these different philosophies. And then I look really at the history of plant-based eating, and I show that, there's so much excitement about the future of food and so much talk about like what's the future of food, and it's often emphasized that it's going to have a lot of technology at the center. But I look at that, historically, until about 50 to 70 years ago, we were eating very richly diverse plant-based diets with a lot of different culinary legacies. And I'd really love for us not to forget, those incredible recipes that our grandmothers and others have developed over time. And so I would say that the narrative arc of the book really is trying to situate this movement and historically, and then come to this, this place where I really want to encourage readers to really get clear about their own values around the food system and, make choices that are in alignment with those values when they choose to put what they choose to put on their plate. And I think a through line as well is, Wendell Berry, who is a poet, a farmer and novelist, he famously says that eating is an agricultural act. And I also
Wait,
really think that a
eating
through
is an
line
agricultural
An
act?
agricultural act, that's right. And I really, of course it is. It's also political, it's economic, it's cultural. But I really believe that eating is also a spiritual act. So going back to, the vegetarians in your community that you mentioned, I think that there is a reason that they avoid animal flesh historically, because there's this notion of, do unto others as you would have done unto yourself, right? So there's this notion of reducing harm. And I think that that's also a very present through line in the book as well.
We talk about factory farms, which are sort of the worst possible way to produce food. And yet, here in Iowa, it's almost impossible. Our state government has made it almost impossible to move away from it. Because as far as in my opinion, they're in the, big ag, the not the fa it's not the family farmers, although they get caught up in it too, because a lot of the people who want to farm now are raising, they have to compete with those factory farmers. They often grow hogs mostly here. Well, there's also actually we do a lot of eggs in Iowa, so there's a lot of factory chicken farms too, but that they're doing it for these big companies, and that's the only way to make a living. So there's this whole economic structure and governmental structure that it you look at it and you just it's almost impossible to fight. And it's kind of depressing. So we have a organization here in Fairfield, Jefferson, what is it? It's JFAN, Jefferson County Friends and Neighbors, I think. But where what that's trying to keep the CAFOs out, away out of our county as much as possible. And there's very limited, even when we are able to elect county supervisors who want to regulate this, it's very they're very limited by state law as to what how much they can regulate. So we have so little local control over it. I don't, are you familiar with what's going on
Absolutely.
out here in the mid
Just yes, to some extent, to the extent that I can. But I think that often where I live in the Bay Area, of course, it's a bubble, right? People kind of think that there's
Yeah.
this shift, and there is. I mean, it has a cultural impact, but the reality of most people's lives is that they live in places where the only food that they have access to, and this includes plants as well, that are grown on monoculture fields and they're not necessarily organic and so on. And then CAFOs, concentrated animal feeding operations, otherwise known as factory farms, they are the worst of the worst, and they're also the most dominant. So it's actually, people think that, if I buy like cage-free eggs, et cetera, at the farm, at the supermarket, it's actually the vast majority of the animal products that we consume are, 99% are from like what we would consider factory farms. And so I do talk about in this book as a sociologist that there's a limit to what we can do as individual consumers. I think that the documentary Food Inc., which when it first came out, there was a raising of consciousness around what the role of the consumer is. But the second one that just came out, also with the same folks, including Michael Pollan, really shows the dominance of food conglomerates and industry consolidation, and the fact that, policy and state and federal laws, I mean, the entire structure is, as you say, this is what we mean when we say the food system, is the incentives are toward profit and toward companies making more bang for their buck, and very much the externalized costs are on the on society. So it's on animal suffering, it's on human health, and of course the food and
And it's on our
pharmaceutical and
water
health
quality
industries,
here in Iowa. That's a
water
big deal.
quality.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, land use, water quality, the runoff, the pollution impact on communities, I mean, communities of color in particular around the country. It is really daunting. And to be honest, writing this book was at times quite depressing because I was really learning like very, very dark truths about our food system. And for a while, it really got me down because I was thinking, just like you, like what can I do as a consumer? What can I do as a teacher and as a an advocate that's co-founded a nonprofit with our students as well? And I came to realize that, I am someone who can make choices in my own life. I can inspire people to also try to make even little baby steps in their own life. And I'm a storyteller, so I really want to raise consciousness, in our country, in our communities, and then also abroad. But as a storyteller, I think my role is to really raise these questions and really get people to think carefully about, what goes on their plate. I think the more people that there are who are aware of how food is produced, the more I think there can be pushback against these policies. And hopefully, like, these younger Gen Zs, I'm hoping that they'll actually
Vote.
gain positions of power
Yeah.
politically and so on, that and I know my role as a storyteller, but I'm so excited for our students who are part of our nonprofit because many of them are actually going to go into some of them into the industry incumbent companies, and we're hoping that they can make change from within, and also policy shifts are very important. But it is daunting. At the same time, we make choices 3 times a day about what to put on our plate. And of course, those choices are constrained by our economic means and our, food access. I mean, obviously, food access is a huge issue, especially in communities of color where there literally isn't even a grocery store in the neighborhood. That I think is really the extreme example of people not having access to any quality of foods. But for those of us who have the privilege and opportunity to eat better and actually to, just try to make change, I think we can do what we can. But it is daunting. It really is. The food system is extremely complex. And I think I thought I knew something about food when I finished my dissertation. And if anything, writing this book made me realize just how little I knew in a way. It's like the more I learned, the less I felt like I knew because it's so complicated.
So, Nina, what made you decide to write this book?
Well, it's simply that people don't read dissertations. I think
Ah.
that was part of it. That was part of it. I felt like I had put in 5 years of really intense work into my thesis. And, very few people read dissertations except for the dissertation committee. Although, strangely enough, people have reached out to me. They find it online and they tell me that they read it, which is amazing to me. But that dissertation is very theoretical. It's a very sociologically kind of rigorous study. And I wanted to really go on my own journey of discovering, as you asked, like, what is my role in trying to cultivate a more just, nourishing, and sustainable food system? And that was a humbling journey because I realized how little I actually knew and how many more questions I had than answers. And so the book was a kind of an expedition into the food system, and I want to take readers along for the journey to, so that they can make up their own minds about what kind of role they want to play in that food system.
Well, I will say, as depressing as it can be looking at like our government and so forth, there are people here in Iowa who are doing wonderful things. We have the Sustainable Iowa Land Trust that is farmers are donating their or sometimes they're selling their farms to this trust where it is guaranteed that it will only organic production will be done on these farms,
That's
and I
incredible.
know, and they're
That's
getting
incredible.
young farmers a chance who want to grow that way. And then they have this current project, Circle Our Cities, which is to have like 10 local, 10 farms producing local food for local production around each of the cities in Iowa, and or maybe more depending on the size of the city. And I know they've done some, some really great things. And we're fortunate if you for dairy here, we have a not just organic dairy, but it's called Radiance Farms, and the calves stay with the mothers, and they move them from pasture to pasture. It's completely grass-fed. They're moved every day from, to fresh pasture, and just very, the way that you would want it to be. But as you mention in your book, like for cattle, for beef, even if we moved completely to grass-fed beef, it would be almost impossible to do because of
Well,
the
yes, I
resource
mean,
limitations.
I wanted to tackle that topic of grass-fed, beef and dairy and so on because it's often proposed as the alternative to our current food system. And, I think that I can see the philosophy behind it. It makes sense in many ways that if people want to eat meat or dairy, that this is a better approach. I mean, at least the cattle are eating the food that they're supposed to eat rather than corn and soy grown in monoculture fields. In places like Iowa and other places where so much of that land and that caloric potential of those plant-based calories go toward factory farming feed, and then in return we get much fewer calories of beef and other animal products, and so it's really wasteful. And so grass-fed beef and dairy, I think, are one of the proposed solutions. And I interview someone who I knew at Harvard. He was a graduate student and a friend of mine who is now a professor at NYU, Matthew Hayek, whose research is really phenomenal on this topic. And he simply shows that, if we were to shift toward a grass-fed beef system, we would also have to really reduce meat consumption simply because, as you say, if you're going to move cattle from pasture to pasture and they're always on fresh pasture, and most of the time they're not moved enough. So there's kind of this idealism around it, and then there's the practice of they're not actually moved enough, and so they it's too concentrated essentially still, even though they're not on feedlots. And we would have to, we couldn't match the current consumption of meat essentially. And so that's why I think that those solutions, the regenerative agriculture, otherwise known as grass-fed beef, that is a solution that is only possible if we really vastly reduce meat consumption. And that's why I think veganism and regenerative agriculture, grass-fed beef, are actually very aligned. Because I think, if all of us were to really eat, just once a week, this grass-fed beef that is much more expensive, and actually the cost is not artificially lowered as it is by government subsidies for feedlot meat. And if it actually was, the cost actually reflected the environmental impact and the farmer's labor and all of that, and they would be very high, Yes, they would be inaccessible to eat every single day, but they would be accessible to eat maybe once a week. And so I would love to live in that world where people ate grass-fed beef once a week. That would be a huge improvement on the food system that we have now. So that's why I'm in alignment. Matthew Hayek, my friend, calls this a kind of agricultural harm reduction approach. And I see it that way. If we are going to eat meat, I think that is probably the way to do it. But I think, personally, it's hard enough navigating that system that for me, it's kind of easier to just, and philosophically feels in alignment for me not to eat meat. But I see a world in which we have, grandmother's dinner on Sunday nights, just once in a week we have meat like we used to in the 1940s and 30s and before that. And I think that that's a world that I could live in.
Well, Nina, would you like to read from The Good Eater for us?
Absolutely. It would be my pleasure. I'm not the person you might expect to tell the story of how veganism entered the mainstream. My parents weren't hippies, and I ate plenty of meat and dairy earlier in my life. I was born in the Soviet Union in a tiny country called Moldova, landlocked between Romania and Ukraine, to a modest family of Russian, Ukrainian, and Jewish origins. Growing up in the rubble of the collapse, we didn't have much choice about what to eat. As a child, I remember hearing stories from my parents and grandparents about the long lines for basics like milk and bread. My father routinely woke before sunrise to stand in line for a jug of milk that he manually churned into cottage cheese. In the summers, my grandparents rented a trailer by the woods and foraged for mushrooms, not as a hobby, but out of necessity. As the days grew colder, they'd spend days canning, preserving, and carefully storing food for the long, harsh winters. When I was 7 years old, we won the golden ticket, a chance to try our luck at the North American dream. After applying to various countries, we were accepted as immigrants to Canada, mostly because its immigration system selects for those with higher educational backgrounds. And both my parents had been working on doctorates in physics. They were forced to drop out when the Soviet Union collapsed. When the Iron Curtain was drawn back, it revealed a people hungry for the Western way of life, including its food. And our new life in Toronto meant a world of delicacies opened up to our inexperienced palates. At the grocery store, I marveled at the seemingly endless array of fruit yogurts, whole aisles of potato chip bags, gigantic racks of barbecued ribs, sugary cereals, tubs of ice cream in every flavor, and muffins, pies, and cakes made ready to eat. Costco especially left an impression. More food than I could ever imagine under one roof, and a fridge at home big enough to store it. I used to roam the aisles as my parents shopped, unable to fully comprehend the abundance before me. The cornucopia was a revelation, and we quickly adopted the Western diet without a second thought. That's why, when I was a teenager, we were shocked when my father suddenly announced that he wanted to be a vegetarian. My dad had grown up in an obscure village in a country nobody had heard of, and yet for years, he had apparently harbored a desire to give up meat. When he took up yoga and meditation to deal with the intense pressures of immigrant life, he felt a kinship with the Indian philosophical principle of ahimsa, nonviolence, which preaches vegetarianism. Odd pucks of faux meat appeared in our freezer. Large tubs of mixed nuts filled the cupboards, and soon my dad was putting a weird green paste on his toast, which I found totally off-putting. This was way before avocado toast became a trendy thing. Our Russian friends, of course, made fun of him, teasing him with remarks about the loss of manliness and warning that he would never feel satiated again. My dad wasn't sure he'd manage this transition, but he decided to give it a try out of moral principle. My sister and I got on the bandwagon mostly because we admired his convictions. My mother, as well as her parents, who lived with us, as in many immigrant families, eventually had no choice but to accept the dietary divide in our house, a Berlin Wall of opposing food ideologies. My boor babushka now generously cooked two separate dinners. For many years, my vegetarianism wasn't a big part of my identity. If anything, I gladly compensated for the lack of meat in my diet with a hearty serving of dairy, yogurt, ice cream, and especially cheese. My love affair with cheese blossomed when I went to France for the first time at 17. Like countless cliched Francophiles before me, I strolled the Parisian streets, sampling every funky and creamy concoction. Who would deny themselves such pleasures? My mother used to say, vegans don't enjoy living, and your average French person would wholeheartedly agree with her. But as is often the case with big life changes, a personal tragedy unexpectedly shifted my attitude. At the time, I was a couple of years into my graduate program in sociology at Harvard University, and I decided rebelliously to ditch Cambridge for the south of France while I studied for my general exams. I bought a one-way ticket to Nice, where I rented a tiny studio apartment on the outskirts of the city. In between study sessions at the rocky beach, I strolled the streets of the old town and blissfully, for ignorance truly can be blissful, I enjoyed all the gelato, brie, and pastries I fancied. Then one day, my father called me. My grandfather's cancer had taken a turn for the worse. My beloved Dedushka was the wise old grandfather of storybooks. I had last seen him over winter break after he'd had a medical emergency over Novy God, the Russian New Year. Rather than celebrating, I spent the holiday cooking meals, shuttling between hospitals, and translating doctor's orders. I will never forget the drear yellow of the walls, which contrasted so di distinctly with my own feeling of vibrant health while spending days in waiting rooms. We thought he'd turn a corner, but now my father said over the phone, he was gone. The loss of our Dedushka was devastating, and yet, as those who have experienced grief know, sometimes a glimmer of hope emerges out of the darkness. My grandfather's passing was the catalyst that inspired me to research the link between diet and disease, something I had never bothered to do before. What I found rocked me to my core, offering a glimpse of another reality where my whole family might have made different food choices and where my Dedushka might have enjoyed more years of good health. I learned that nutritional research had long shown that those following a plant-based diet have significantly lower rates of mortality from major diseases, lower body weight, and longer lifespans. I learned that only 5 to 10% of cancers are attributable to genetic defects, which means that the vast majority of cancers are rooted in environmental and lifestyle factors. That includes breast, prostate, colorectal, endometrial, gallbladder, and pancreatic cancers. In fact, there's strong evidence to suggest that a diet of exclusively or even mostly whole foods, plants, can treat and even reverse disease, including cancer. How is it that this information was not widely known? That summer, I went down a rabbit hole. Slowly, I learned many disturbing truths about our food system, including the outsized impact of the animal agriculture industry on climate change and chronic disease. I educated myself about the overuse of antibiotics on factory farms, a potentially cataclysmic problem that creates treatment-resistant bacterial strains that could be a catastrophic blow to modern medicine. Unlike many of the most zealous converts, I didn't embrace the vegan lifestyle overnight. For me, it was a gradual process, 2 steps forward, 1 step back, until one day I found myself on the other side of an impossible divide and could no longer ignore the consequences of what I put on my plate. Although my new knowledge couldn't save my grandfather, it forever changed my own life.
Thank you. That was Nina Gilbeau reading from The Good Eater, A Vegan Search for the Future of Food. So when you talked about that you were writing on a narrative arc, and did you have that sort of the plan for that in place before you started the book?
I think that every book is different, and I think even if I were to write another one, it might be completely different. I think I knew that I wanted to, tell the story of veganism from multiple different angles, but I wasn't quite clear on exactly how it would progress. It really landed into place as I wrote, and so some chapters shifted, but there was a general arc of, the history of veganism to the present day, and then some of the critics and the future of food.
And did you have to do a lot of research as you were writing this book, or had you already done all the research when you wrote your dissertation and you're just sort of maybe digging a little deeper in a few places?
I wish I had, and actually, when I started writing the book, I thought it would take me a year because I had already done my dissertation, and I thought it would be quite easy to transition from the dissertation to the book. And actually, again, Michael Pollan, my mentor, said that the shift from academic writing, where you're writing more as a figure of authority, somebody with this very authoritative voice, to a narrative nonfiction book is actually quite a jump, because in a narrative nonfiction book, I think there's Michael Pollan actually told me people don't really like to read from experts for the most part when they're reading a nonfiction book. I mean, yes, it's helpful if the person knows what they're talking about, but you kind of want to be taken on a journey of a beginner's mind, you know? And so I had to kind of forget everything that I knew and restart. And it actually was helpful because I found out that there's actually still a lot that I didn't know. And so I really did come to it with this, kind of openness and a sense of beginner's mind. And that was really quite challenging for me. And so really finding my narrative voice was really the challenge of this book. And I didn't expect it to be as hard as it was, honestly, transitioning from academic writing.
So, did you have to do a lot of editing,
Absolutely,
self-editing?
yes. A lot of editing. I had a lot of first drafts that were quite terrible, or just pieces of things that I had a map, and I thought that I could just follow the map, because again, with the dissertation, there was a kind of intellectual architecture in place where you have the sort of like what have people done before, what is your research, what is your contribution, here are the methods, here are the hypotheses. There's a flow already with academic writing. With a narrative nonfiction book, there's so many possible arcs. There's so many ways of partitioning content. It could be in parts. At first, the book was of four parts, and then it kind of flowed better as one story. And even just the flow from chapter to chapter was difficult to achieve. And also, even putting myself into the book, which is something I really resisted, because again, as an academic, I just feel more comfortable presenting the science and sort of taking it back, a kind of authoritative back seat. But in this book, I realized I had to write about my family. I had to write about myself, why I became interested in this topic. And that was actually quite challenging. For me, I really actually in general enjoy writing scenes. So the parts of the book where you're there with me, with someone, that's the part that I really enjoy writing. Unfortunately for me, I got the book deal right when the pandemic started. So I would have preferred
Oh
to
my.
have a lot more scenes, because I'm an ethnographer by training. So I'm somebody who goes into the field. I really talk to people. I like to set scenes. In that sense, I'm almost prefer kind of novel, almost novel-like writing to science writing. But that took, I had to really, this book ended up being much more of a meditation and a kind of philosophical kind of meditation on how to eat rather than kind of field work based, because I didn't have the option of doing field work. And so the pieces that you see where I did do field work, that was either from my dissertation or it was when the pandemic started to lessen. But I
Oh
would have
wow.
preferred to have more scenes if possible.
Well, does that mean you need to write another book?
It's funny, my agent asked me, "Are you ready to write another book?" And it was right when I was finishing this one, and I felt like, "You're asking me if I want a baby, have a baby while I'm giving labor. I'm in labor,
Yes,
so."
'cause you don't at that point.
Not at that point, but it's funny because I think a lot of I really admire writers who they feel like they need to write to be alive. I never set out to be a writer. It's very strange to me that I'm a writer, because I didn't set out to be a writer. I just felt like this story needed to be told. And I do feel like I have a gift for writing, but it's difficult for me. It's actually quite torturous sometimes, actually,
Oh
because I'm a bit of a perfectionist. So
wow. Well, this is a question I often ask. As you're working and you're reworking a section of book, how do you know when the book is done? How do you know when it's good enough, when it's as good as you can make
I think it's really helpful to have a team of people who read your
it?
book, friends and family, and then also, of course, an editor and an agent who can help you feel that way. I often didn't want to, I didn't want to surrender drafts of my book to the editor because I felt like they still needed work. And I think, I don't know, I think I'm a recovering perfectionist. So I'm just trying to get to the point where I'm 80% happy with it. And then I know if I'm 80% happy with it, it's probably pretty good, but always with my work, I always, when I read it in retrospect, I often like it a lot better than when I'm actually writing it
Oh, that's good. That's good. I was afraid you were
yeah,
going to say when I go read it, I see
so
all the things I wish I'd done differently.
no, I mean, I think that's always the case with a project, because it's always, it's interesting because it's alive, right? So even my perspective on food now is shifting with time, but it's this kind of cross-sectional view into someone's perspective on something. But I really do, honestly, I feel it is, you know, I did co-author a book when I was an undergrad, but this book really is my first solo authored book, and I feel very proud of it because I feel like the shift from academic writing to narrative nonfiction was very challenging, and I'm proud of myself for that. And I also feel like it really does encapsulate what I think about food. It really does contain everything I want to say about food.
Well, that's amazing. So, what would you write about something different for your next book?
You know, it's funny, a lot of people ask me if this book is a cookbook. I think also because the cover has vegetables on it, and I
Yes.
really, yeah, and I really do love to cook as well, and I'm quite a good cook or chef, and I thought about that, but there's so many amazing people already, you know, doing that, and I am just really interested in the human condition. I'm really interested in relationships, love and connection, and so I might write a book something on that topic, but I'm always going to see things as an ethnographer and as a sociologist. I'm always going to try to understand how dynamics of society work in some way. So I don't know exactly what I'm working on next, but I think subject matter might change.
Well, some of my favorite cookbooks are only a few recipes with a lot of story. So maybe something like
Yeah. Actually, it's
that.
funny because I said if I write anything about food, it'll be something like culinary history mixed with recipes, but not just the recipe book. Very much like I always imagined, you know, a cookbook where you're taken behind like the story of an ingredient and the time and a place, because food is so deeply nostalgic and cultural. And so that's
Right.
the only kind of cookbook that I want. A philosophical cookbook, essentially.
I love it. I think that's great. Well, Nina, we're out of time, and I want to thank you for being with us today. You know, we always close with a quote, and I have one from Albert Einstein.
One of my favorites from
Vegetarian
the
vegetarian food leaves a deep impression on our nature. If the whole world adopts vegetarianism, it can change the destiny of humankind.
Perfect quote that
Yeah.
encapsulates the book. Thank you so much, Monica. It was so much fun to talk to you. It's a pleasure.
It was a pleasure to talk to you, and see you all next week on Writer's Voices.